So when I hand over, start fucking.
Hello.
Wait. How does that go? At least we got the fuck ups out of the way early.
Oh, fuck. I stepped on the dog's ball.
From the burning mesas of the Arizona desert to the slot machine clad boardwalks of New Jersey, it's The Imaginarium with Scott and Todd. I'm Scott Colbert.
I'm the horror nerd, Todd Starooch.
I always like to be transparent about the show whenever possible.
Uh-oh.
I mean, you know, not that we ever have anything to hide or anything Uh-oh. Worth hiding. But as I was posting this week's podcast, I realized that we had missed a week, or I had missed a week, and the last time that I had posted something was on the 12th, and there should have been one right after that. And for the life of me, I couldn't remember if we had not recorded this, you know, one day this week or this month. And I was racking my brains. I couldn't remember. So that's when I messaged you and asked you about that. And of course, you found it, you know, the one that we recorded on the 18th or whatever it was that I didn't post. And Todd, for the life of me, I don't remember not even ask, because you know I always ask you to send it.
Right.
If you don't send it. And I don't know if either of us had brain farts or what was going on, but we missed a week. So there's an extra Imaginarium lurking around. I haven't edited it yet, but I will when I edit this particular podcast that we're recording now, so that we will have an extra episode somewhere down the line, or we'll just post it if you can't record. I haven't decided which one to do because I don't know what we talked about on this episode.
Neither do I.
So I don't know if there's anything timely on
We're
it.
We're professionals,
not.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, right.
So when you said that, I was like, you know what? I didn't even notice that you didn't post an episode that week. Like, I'm like, oh, we're good. Oh my God. Can you imagine, like, NBC? Yeah, we forgot to air last week's episode of Law and Order Special Victims Unit. We'll just get caught up at some point down the road.
Right.
Oh my God. We're professionals.
But you know what? In almost a decade of doing this, that's never happened before that I can remember.
Not that I remember, you know.
But apparently our memories can't be relied upon because
not anymore.
So my apologies to all two of you who are waiting for a podcast the week that it wasn't aired. We'll make it up to you and give you your money's worth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and since you don't pay anything, that's exactly the worth that you're going to get.
Right? Oh, my God. Well, hey, that's funny. That's just funny shit.
All right. So we have some deaths to talk about real quick.
We do, and this one, he passed away back on March 7th, and I guess we just missed it, or maybe we did talk about him and totally don't remember, but
that's possible.
Yeah, so Steve Lawrence, singer-songwriter Steve Lawrence passed away, famously of Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet.
Yep.
You know, Steve and Edie, you know, just, they were one of those just Vegas acts, you know, that were on talk shows all the time.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, played Vegas all the time. I actually saw them very late in their careers in Vegas at the Stardust before they tore it down. I just happened to be in town and there was a big show at the Stardust and it was all, you know, it was Engelbert Humperdinck, Steve and Edie, Wayne Newton, like all the old time Vegas people. And everyone, of course, makes fun of me. But you know me, Scott, I'm a Las Vegas guy. And I'm always into, whether it's Hollywood or Vegas, I'm a fan of like the golden era of all that shit. So for me, it was a big deal to see all those people. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, no,
you know.
No,
I was definitely one of the younger people in the audience. And even then, I was like in my late 40s, you know. So
no, but the thing about that is I remember, you know, those summer vacations that I would take with my parents, you know, in the cars cross country, and Vegas was always a stop when we were going out to California or the West somewhere. And I remember we would always, you know, drive down the strip and you'd see, you know, the huge signs, Don Rickles performing tonight, Stephen Eady, Elvis at one point, because we went there when Elvis was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I get that. I get that. And if I was in Las Vegas and that show was going around, I probably would have tried to have seen that too. I mean, and when you think of like Steve Lawrence, I mean, that is like the quintessential lounge singer.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and he was also, you know, a semi-regular on the Carol Burnett show. He was on there a shitload of times.
That is true. That is true.
And he was a good comic actor.
He was. I mean, and for those who don't remember, like his one of his big hits was Go Away, Little Girl. That was like his big radio hit. And then Edie Gourmet did Blame It on the Bossa Nova.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. They had a couple, you know, they had some really big hits. And like people just, you know, people don't realize it, you know. Yeah, that's too bad. We say it all the time, my friend. All of the, you know, the entertainers of that generation are dropping like flies, you know?
Yeah, and he was 80-something.
Let's see. I have it. I actually have it right here. Blum, 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 blum. 88.
Oh, wow. Almost 88. 90. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, that's a pretty good run.
Yeah, that is a good run.
But yeah, I just always remember Stephen Eady, like you never saw, you didn't, until she passed away. She passed away, I think, like a decade or so ago. It was a long time. They all, you know, you just you never saw one without the other. So
no.
which was adorable.
And they were, you know, they were on just about every variety show that you could imagine multiple times. You know, they were just a rock solid choice to have as a guest, no matter what type of show you did, whether it was a talk show or a variety show or whatever the case may be. I think they may have even had their own show at one point in the 60s.
I don't remember that, but that again, I wasn't even born until 1968. So that, and I didn't realize, I'm looking at it now on the obit, that Steve and Edie actually met on the Tonight Show.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah. He was, you know, would appear as a guest, and then he became a regular, and back when Steve Allen was the host. And then Edie was a background singer and part of the cast, and they met there and got married. So, how cute.
Yeah. I don't know if Go Away Little Girl could have been released today just because of Little Girl, people would take that the wrong way
probably. And holy shit, what do you now listen, I did never thought that Steve Lawrence was his real name, but what do you know, I never knew this, do you know what Steve Lawrence's real name was?
Not a clue. Something Yiddish.
Yep. Sidney Leibovitz.
Yeah, that
go figure.
that's about as Jewish as you can get.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you know, real quick, Donny Osmond had a hit with Go Away Little Girl.
That's true. That is true.
And that sounded more forthcoming from Donny Osmond singing it than Steve Lawrence when he did.
Yeah. All right. Well, rest in peace, Steve Lawrence. And then yesterday, as we record this, it's not really entertainment related, but former Senator Joe Lieberman passed away. He was a Connecticut state senator and then a U.S. senator. So he was, you know, he was a very prominent figure here in the north, in the Northeast, especially because he always kind of was an independent, you know. And I just remember, you know, he was very critical of Bill Clinton and his affair and everything, and was really one of the few Democrats to be critical of him. So just a quick note, you know, because he was just kind of an icon. And I thought I thought he had passed away already.
Yeah, you know? And, you know, and he was, you know, as critical as he was of Bill Clinton, he still managed to become the VP VP nominee, I should say, anyway, with Al Gore.
Yes.
When he ran in 2000.
Yeah, absolutely. Damn, yeah. 2000 is almost 24 years ago already. Oh, my God.
I know, right?
Because I process that shit.
I had heard that news yesterday, and I was trying to think, well, shit. I knew he was VP, you know, the VP nominee with Gore. And I'm like, Christ, when was that? And I was thinking 96 for some reason. Then I saw it was 2000. And I'm like, oh, holy shit. You know, where did that time go? And then once I realized it was 2000, I remembered everything that I was doing and where I was when, you know, the whole debacle about the election going on. The original, they stole the election election.
Yeah, the hanging chads.
Hard to believe that's probably in history books now.
Right? Right? Yeah, I assure you, like if I said, and my daughter is, you know, very politically minded, and I bet if I told me and said hanging chad to her, she would think it would have something to do with some jerk off on her campus or something. You know?
Or was a dirty term for something.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it sounds, you know, it sounds vaguely obscene. How's your hanging chad?
Exactly. all right. Well, so before we get to our topic, though, I did see a movie this week. I saw Late Night with the Devil.
I've been wanting to see that. I've heard nothing but good things about it.
You absolutely should see it. You absolutely should see it. It's really, really good. First of all, I always mispronounce his name, but David Desmalchian or Desmalchian is the star, and he's just like a creepy dude, like to begin with, and he's just really good in this. Just the whole thing is really cool. They managed to recreate like that 1970s talk show vibe. And it's one of the found footage style movies that actually works, you know, because so for those of you who don't know what it's about a late night talk show host who is very good, but always like in second place in the ratings, you know, and, as a last ditch effort to be number one, he has a Halloween show where he has on like a psychic, a skeptic, and a woman who claims to be works with a girl who they believe is possessed by a demon. And and let's just say that things go horribly awry, you know? So, but you know, the conceit is, you know, that there's some narration in the beginning that tells you what happened. And then it says, this is the footage of that show that was found, you know, and we're going to show it to you now. It's been lost for all this time. So that's the conceit, and that's why it works as found footage style, because you know how I feel about found footage, Scott. There comes a point in every single one of them where it's like, why the fuck are you still running around with a camera in your hands?
Yeah.
You know, but then it's when it makes sense, because all of it was captured by the TV cameras in the studio. So anyway, I don't want to give anything else.
Oh, excuse me.
Jesus, Scott just died, everybody.
I didn't get the mute button fast enough.
Wow. Good luck editing that. But yeah, so I liked it a lot. And like I said, when I posted about it on my socials, stop whining about prequels and sequels and remakes and just go see this movie. It's a relatively low budget, independent movie, and just see it before it's not in theaters. Show theaters that movies like this can make money, you know? It's really good. I highly recommend it. The girl that plays the possessed girl is super fucking creepy. Like, even when she's not possessed, I'm like, holy shit, I hope I never meet that girl. But it was good. You should see it, Scott. I want to see that. I saw that, and I want to see Immaculate. I've heard really good things about Immaculate.
I'm not familiar with that one.
And plus, it's got Sydney Sweeney and her cleavage in it. So,
I'm still not familiar with that one.
All right. So anyway, yeah, that's it. Just wanted to mention. Okay. Late Night with the Devil. You really should see it.
I will. And, you know, this goes to show, you know, people keep talking about there's nothing good coming out of Hollywood, or there's no good horror movies and blah, 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 blah. You know, the usual bullshit. Well, now is your chance to put up or shut up. If you choose not to see this, you thereby forfeit the right to ever talk shit about movies ever again.
Yeah, and you know how it is. I've said this before. Horror, a lot of horror fans are just full of shit. They complain and complain and complain, yet they will be the first one in line to see the latest Saw movie, you know.
Yep.
But anyway, that's it. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole yet again. Mm-hmm. It's just a really good movie and well made and well acted, and I really dig it.
Awesome. All right. Well, I would definitely check that out. All right. So we actually do have a topic today. We have one of our, you know, favorite type lists. And I got the idea for this because I messaged you the idea about this on Monday. At work, when we have free time, we can read at our, you know, cubicles, for lack of a better word. So I've been reading Stephen King's The Outsider, and that was made into an HBO miniseries. And the book is fantastic. It's one of my favorites of his more recent works. And the adaptation that they did for HBO was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And that just gave me the idea for today's topic, you know, book to movie translations that didn't suck and were actually really good. And in some cases, even better than the book. And I'm not going to include The Outsider on that because I actually finished watching the miniseries, I think, Tuesday. And it could make the list, but it's not quite there, not with the other movies that I had in mind. But it's definitely worth checking out. I know you'll never get to it because of your never going to watch pile of movies right. That I keep telling you you should see and don't. So that's the topic today. So, and my first one, it's a little bit of a throwback. It would actually be really easy for me to just do all horror on this, but I kind of wanted to broaden the horizons and show that, you know, I have more than a narrow focus in horror. So my, excuse me, my first one is, drum roll, please. Jesus Christ, I just forgot.
You didn't fucking write them down? Even I have a little notepad open on my computer.
Oh, God. It's the Gregory Peck movie from the 60s.
To Kill a Mockingbird?
To Kill a Mockingbird. And it was right there on the tip of my fucking tongue. And I just... And this is happening more and more often, but that's a story for another day, my memory. But To Kill a Mockingbird, yes, that is my first one. Book was done by Harper Lee. And not that the book is better than the the movie is better than the book in this case, or vice versa. They're both very strong. They are worthy companions to one another. You kind of get more of the characters, you know, backgrounds and stuff like that in the book than you do in the movie. Because, you know, I mean, let's face it, you know, you only have a limited amount of time to watch a movie or to make a movie. So, you know, the thing, you're never going to get everything from a book into a movie. But To Kill a Mockingbird does it about as good as any movie has ever done it. And, of course, you know, Gregory Peck was nominated for an Oscar. I can't remember if he won it for that or not.
I don't remember.
But the, you know, the acting is first rate. The cinematography is first rate. It's just a fantastic movie. And it's one of those movies that everybody should be required to watch in high school.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's funny. When you said that this was going to be our topic, I was very excited, but it was really difficult, like, to narrow it down. Like, my list here in front of me that I'm looking at has way more than five on it. And I said, well, once we start recording, I'll just pick them at the last minute. But of course, To Kill a Mockingbird is on my list. Like, it's overall. And then I said, well, I'm sure Scott might pick one or two of these. So at least, you know, I won't run out. So yeah, no, I agree. And most people do agree that this is one of the best book to film adaptations out there. So that is a really good first choice.
Yes.
Excellent.
It's a good way to kick off this show.
I agree. So, I don't, of course, mine are not in any particular order, but my first one is not horror either. But, oh, and you know, we didn't specify like how we were going to do this. But I stuck on my list to books that I have actually read the book and seen the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I did too.
Okay, because yeah. We didn't really specify. And then I said, well, how could I possibly judge if I haven't read the book? You know, well, even though some people will.
Yeah, know? I mean, that was my, you know, that's my thinking. You know, how could I make this comparison if I haven't read the fucking book?
Right. So my first one is The Princess Bride. I love the book. The book is by William Goldman is very hefty compared to the movie. Like, there's a lot more dialogue and some backstory and, you know, and scenery describing and stuff. So the author of The Princess Bride, William Goldman, was also a very experienced screenwriter. So he adapted his own novel. And it's very obviously knew what he was doing because he basically just lifted all the good, exciting parts and put them in the movie. And that's why, like, The Princess Bride, to me, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies, my top five in movies. And I just think it's a perfect book to film adaptation, again, for that reason. Trim some of the stuff that's in a book that you don't mind reading because it fills in your imagination, yeah. But you don't want a 4-hour movie, you know?
No.
So, yeah, to me, it's just one of the most perfect book to movie adaptations all the time. It's got something for everybody. It's got love story, high adventure. It's got wit and charm. So there you go. That's my first one, The Princess Bride.
All right. And here's my next one. And this is a case where I think the movie is much better than the book, and it's The Godfather.
Mm.
Now, it's been a very long time since I actually read The Godfather. But I remember it being very overblown and cheesy and dramatic and, quite honestly, not very well written. So the fact that Mario Puzo was actually, you know, able to co-write a decent, you know, award-winning screenplay for the movie is testament to how talented he actually turned out to be. And I mean, this book, when it came out, was huge, huge. My parents had it, and they didn't read at all at the time, anyway. But you know, it's, you know, The Godfather. What can you say about that? It's, you know, considered, you know, one of the best movies ever made, and I still kind of agree with that. I'm not sure if I would put it in my top five, but it certainly would be in my top 10 somewhere. Probably around 9 or 8 if I had to list it. But I don't know if you've ever read the book.
I read it, though, after I saw the movie. So it was, I wanted to just, and that was a long time ago, too. I wanted to see if the movie really was as good as the book, you know?
And I, as I said, I thought it was better. What did you think?
I think they're equal. It's just different because it's a different medium. And yeah. You know, like for me, for years, when people said, what's your favorite movie of all time? It was The Godfather. And then over time, I think, I'm pretty sure I like The Godfather Part Two better than The Godfather.
Yeah, I can see that.
But compared to the book, I think I agree with you. I mean, the movie is a little better, but you know, in terms of this topic, it's definitely one of the best book to movie adaptations. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, obviously The Godfather is still in print, and even though I'm not as crazy about the book as I am the movie, it's definitely worth a read. It's a little dated, I would say, and I don't know that the book holds up as well as the movie does. And I have no doubt people would find offensive things in it to get all shook up about in today's society and class climate. But it's definitely worth a read.
Absolutely. Good one.
Yeah.
All right. So my second one is also, well, it's not horror as people generally define horror, but it deals with a horrific thing. And this is another one where I read the book after I saw the movie. I had the book on my shelf forever and just had never read it. And then after the movie, I wanted to read it. And it's Schindler's List by Thomas Keneally. And man, Spielberg really did capture the horrors enumerated in the book. On screen, he changes the chronology of the book. The book happens in a different order, and there's a lot that got cut for the screen because, again, it was a long movie to begin with. It would have been like an 11-hour movie if he filmed the book exactly as written. But the way, like, the horrors of the Holocaust were translated from the book to the movie is just fantastic. So I think most people have seen Schindler's List. If you have, and you really want to get an even better understanding, you definitely have to read the book.
Yes. But
yeah, that's my second pick is Schindler's List.
That's another book I've not read. But whenever I hear Schindler's List now, I keep thinking of that Seinfeld episode where Elaine is caught laughing during Schindler's List. And I forget why she's laughing at it. But she ends up getting chased out of the theater.
I don't remember that. I was not a big Seinfeld fan during its run. I only know like a handful of episodes, and I don't remember. I have no frame of reference for that. So
well, it It's one of the better episodes. It's just really funny. But I love Schindler's List, the movie. And I think if Spielberg had actually made that movie today, it would have been on Netflix as a miniseries, you know, like
Absolutely. I agree.
And I don't think that it's a bad idea to maybe do that. You know, I doubt he would ever want to go back to that since he did it once. But I think an adaptation of that book done right with the right director as a miniseries would probably be as captivating as Spielberg's movie. And that was another movie that he got screwed on at the Oscars.
Yeah, he, I forget. Something dopey.
Yeah.
One. Hold on. Schindler's List. No, wait. 1994. What do you mean? So.
He was up for Best Director, I think, for that, and he didn't win.
Ah, yes, you're right. Because I'm thinking, I'm looking it up. Oh, no, he did. Best Director, winner, Steven Spielberg, Schindler's List. Yep. What the fuck are we even talking about?
All right.
Boy, and then, let's see, what was Best Picture? Yeah, and Schindler's List was Best Picture. I was thinking of the year that Shakespeare in Love won for Best Picture.
Yeah.
And it beat out something like way more deserving, but I'm not going to go down that trail right now.
Yeah.
Because then I will totally derail this whole episode.
Right.
Complaining about things that should have won an Oscar but didn't.
Yeah, because immediately three or four movies just sprint to mind when you said that. Right,
exactly. Exactly. All right, what's up next?
All right. Next one for me is one of my favorite books, and the movie adaptation is as enjoyable as the book, and that's The World According to Garp.
Mm.
It was Robin Williams' first movie role, you know, first leading role anyway, and it's based on the Joan Irving novel. Now, anybody who knows me knows that outside of my favorite horror writers like, you know, Stephen King and Anne Rice and Clive Barker and et cetera, you know, one of my favorite writers is John Irving. And what I love about John Irving's novels and what I try to incorporate into my own work are the characters that he creates. As eccentric as they may be, they are still very vivid. He can create characters like nobody else. I always refer to him as a 20th century Charles Dickens because, you know, the scope of his books and the topics that he writes about at times, and the characters and the names and the quirks and eccentricities, they all remind me of the stuff that Dickens wrote in, like, Great Expectations, Nicholas Nickleby, et cetera, et cetera. And World According to Garp is no different. It features a trans character played by John Lithgow at a time when, you know, nobody knew what a trans character was. You know, they were looked at, you know, as freaks and something to be shunned. And they certainly do show that in the movie, although not as much as he does in the book. But it's just a wonderful movie. It's very funny. It's very dramatic. Robin Williams gives a fantastic, subdued performance. And it just, it's one of those movies and one of those books that you have to both see and read. And the book holds up well, because I read it just a couple of years ago, and it's still fantastic.
All right, good call. I love the movie. I have not read the book. So I can't really say, you know, but very cool, man. That was one I had not thought of, you know, obviously, because I hadn't read the book. But I think I want to now. So I'll just add it to the list of books that I would love to read someday.
But never will. It's probably on audio.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Although I know you don't have as long a drive now to see your daughter.
No, definitely not. But still, even I don't like, whenever I'm doing anything in my house, I don't like silence in the house. Yeah. I always have to have something going on in the background. So I do put on Audible, you know, from time to time. So, all right, good one. So let's see. So my number three, what am I going to pick off the list here? Okay, I know, because I think we all knew that I would have to get to a Stephen King at some point, because his adaptations are so hit or miss. Yeah. You know, some of them are amazing and some of them are like, what the fuck happened, you know? But one of the best ones, and it's one of my favorite films of all time, and it's The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, I knew it was going to be that or The Green Mile. You were
right. Based on the novella Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
So the movie is, you know, the movie plays out a little bit differently, you know, than the novella, as far as what happens to the warden and so on and so forth. But the Shawshank Redemption is one of those movies that when I had cable still and I was flipping channels, if Shawshank Redemption was on, regardless of what point of the movie it was, I would finish watching it, you know, because I just never get tired of it.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of the absolute best Stephen King adaptations for my money, and especially since it's relatively short. I mean, it is just a novella, so you're like, well, how are they going to take that and make an, you know, an hour and 45 minute or whatever it is, 2 hour movie out of it? And they did a great job, you know.
Yep.
There's not really any filler, if you will, and it fleshes things out a little more, you know, things that happen very briefly in the book. You know, you get a little more drawn out and a little more fleshed out in the movie, which I think makes it great. So, yep, that's my third one, The Shawshank Redemption.
All right. Just as a bit of an aside here, you know, outside of Hollywood has no original ideas and all Hollywood does is make sequels and whatnot, I think the next biggest trope behind that is, you know, the movies are never as good as the books. You hear that a lot. And as I was, you know, going through the movies that I thought were excellent adaptations, I realized there are far more good adaptations of books than what people think. It's just one of those easy, you know, fallback, you know, populist arguments that really has no merit and holds no water, you know, because there are fantastic adaptations. You know, the ones that we're talking about today are great adaptations. And, you know, there's dozens more that both of us could probably put on this list. And this is another one of those topics that we can probably do again in another year or so and have a totally different list.
Well, let's put it this way. The list I'm looking at in front of me has 15 titles on it. You know, because I said, all right, all of these came to mind barely even thinking about it, you know, and I have to narrow it down to 5 for the recording. Yeah. But no, you're right. It's one of those arguments, and it's just such different, mediums, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the only thing I would say, Scott, is where books, I think, have a little bit of an edge all the way around, is it just forces you to use your own imagination to paint the background and fill in the gaps and stuff like that, you know?
Absolutely.
But to say, oh, the book is just always better, you're right. It's just one of those things that people like to say.
Yeah, and I just don't get that sometimes.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I did write a list. I wrote it at work last night after the phones shut off. But then I forgot to email it to myself.
Ah, nice.
So, you know.
Okay.
There's that memory again. I'm going to be going into an Alzheimer's unit pretty soon, I think. All right, so my next one. Geez, where do I go with this? Because this may be slightly controversial, but I don't care.
Oh, boy.
And this is going to be for a series of books, because I found that the series of movies based on the books were as compelling as the books were, and in some cases did a better job. And it's the Harry Potter movies.
Okay, yeah, that's legit.
You know, people can giggle and snicker and point and whatever, but I absolutely love the movies. I think they're fantastic. They really do a fantastic job of creating, you know, not only Hogwarts, you know, the school, but the Hogsmeade, the town that's right by the school, and you know, the forest, and you know, all of the areas that we've come to know and love from the books are represented so well in the movies, and the casting couldn't have been better. Now I will be honest, you know, the first couple of movies, when the kids were really young, like 11, 12-ish, you know, the acting was a bit dodgy.
They're just 11
or 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, but as the series grew, so did the acting. And by the time the final movie came out, it was just fantastic. The acting and the directing, and it helped that it had the same director for the last few movies. It gave it kind of a continuity of tone and style that was a little bit all over the place with the first three. Chris Columbus directed the first two, and then I can't remember his name now, but he directed Y Tu Mama También for the third one. Alfonso
Cuarón.
Yeah. So, you know, and very different tone, third one from the first two, because the first two are very whimsical. And in the third one, some of that whimsy is kind of washed out. And
by the fourth movie, it starts to get serious. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the fourth movie, there's no fucking whimsy at all.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's all angst.
Yeah. Kids are getting murdered.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, wow. Okay.
You know, and not even talking about Lord, you know, Voldemort, you know, the man who must not be named, or he who must not be named, whatever it's called. You know, and Ralph Fiennes, who did such a fantastic job in that role under all of that makeup, too. They're just great movies. I absolutely love them. And what I like is all of those child actors, you know, the main characters, all seem to have survived being child stars and have gone on to do a bunch of different things in their adult life. You know, I mean, Daniel Radcliffe especially, I mean, he's on Broadway now and Merrily We Roll Along.
I know, right?
You know, who would have thought that? You know, and Rupert Grint, he's in I think he's in a TV series now. But he's made some interesting movie choices. But you don't hear all of the horror stories that you tend to hear about child actors and what they had to go through. All of them seem to act like they had a very good time. None of them have, you know, oh, well, you know, I was raped behind the, you know, the castle, you know, by a dragon or something like that. Nobody did anything. Yeah, you know, you don't hear any of that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I think that's refreshing. And I just, those are movies, they're like comfort movies for me. You know, I put them on and I get transported away to this magical place, and then reality hits and then I crawl into my bed for 3 days.
Yeah, no, that's a good choice. I did not read any of the books. I thoroughly enjoyed the movies. My brother has read through the books multiple times over, so I consider him an authority. And he feels that they did a great job adapting the books.
They did. They really did.
And I couldn't tell you, like, along the way, he had nitpicked certain things. You know, I couldn't tell you what they were. I just remember him saying, well, this is a little different, but overall, he was completely thrilled and has watched the movies multiple times as well. So, you know, my brother is an authority. He's a Potterphile. He was at, like, Universal when the Wizarding World opened, you know. So, yeah, I trust his opinion when it comes to all things Harry Potter. So he agrees with you, Scott.
Well, he'll be very happy to hear this, though.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So my next one is a very recent pair of movies. And it's Dune, the current version by Denis Villeneuve. I find to be a fantastic adaptation of Dune. We've talked about the movies, you know, separately on the show. I do like the David Lynch version for what it is. I don't think it's not unfaithful to the book, but to take some creative liberties, let's put it that way, you know. And the new versions, I did not watch the miniseries. I have been told that it's good. I haven't watched it for no real reason other than I just haven't. But I find the current big screen versions to be excellent. Do they change? Are there things that are changed from the book? Yes, we talked about them. I think that's the show that didn't get posted when we talked about Dune Part 2.
No, that was this week's show.
Oh, okay. In that case, don't anyone listen to anything I say.
That's why I titled it How You Dune.
Ah, okay. All right. But anyway, you know, they changed some things, but, you know, and you read interviews by the director, he explains why certain creative choices were made, you know, and they all make sense to me. It wasn't just like I'm doing it because I can. It just made sense from a filmmaking perspective.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I find them to be fantastic. And I'm really looking forward now to part three. And it makes me laugh when part two was about to be released, people were already asking about part three. And of course they were a little dodgy. And then it's like, oh, we're going to have to see how part two does. And I'm like, who are you fucking kidding? You know, it's going to make money. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't know why they haven't announced yet that part three has been greenlit, because they've been hinting at it.
Yeah.
And the way part two ends, you know, it's like, well, now we have to have part three, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but yep. So that's my fourth pick. Dune.
Okay. All right. And since you mentioned Dune, I just want to go on to another little aside.
Okay.
It's the word adaptation. People, for whatever reason, even, you know, 100+ years since movies have been around, you know, people still assume that when they talk about a film adaptation, they just think it's going to be like scene for scene or page for page.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that. And, you know, according to the Oxford Dictionary, adapt means to make something suitable for a new use or purpose, to modify. That means that it's not going to be exactly the same as the book. It can't, which is one of the reasons why a lot of Stephen King adaptations are hit or miss, because there's just things in his books that are unfilmable, because a lot of what makes Stephen King Stephen King are the internal monologues and the dialogues that characters have within themselves. Cujo is a good example of that. You know, a lot of Cujo, the book, is an internal monologue with the dog itself.
Right.
You know, and you just can't really adapt that successfully. Now, having said that, Cujo was on my short list because I absolutely fucking love Cujo the movie.
Mm.
But, you know, people really need to, you know, understand what adaptation means, you know, and it's never going to be the same.
That is a really good point, Scott. Like, I think it also, like, when it really became apparent was when the Marvel movies started coming out and a lot of the hardcore nerds lost their minds.
Yeah.
And it's like, you cannot take a comic book and adapt it directly to the screen, or I should say, convert it directly to the screen, like as written. It just will never work, you know? So I agree with you, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because you're right. A lot of people don't get it, you know?
Yeah.
They don't understand the difference between an original screenplay and an adapted screenplay and things like that. But no, that's a really, really good point.
All right. So what am I up to, my fourth one?
Yeah, no, you're on your last one, because that was my number four, and I think you went first. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right. So my last one is a Stephen King adaptation, and it's an adaptation of my favorite Stephen King book, The Dead Zone. And
I have to pick a new number five now.
And the movie was directed by one of my favorite directors, who I wrote a bunch of essays about that you can purchase at Amazon.com, David Cronenberg.
Yep.
And the book is... Now, there's some differences in the book and the movie, obviously. And there's... Greg Stilson in the book has a much bigger part
right.
to play than he does in the movie. But the genius of David Cronenberg is he really divided the movie into three separate parts. You know, first third being about Johnny Smith and his recovering and finding out about his psychic powers. And, you know, the second part is about the serial killer, Frank Dodd. And then the third part is about Greg Stilson, and when he shakes Stilson's hand at a rally and he sees him starting World War III. So he was genius for doing it that way. And I think really, and I read the book again not all that long ago, it was probably the only way that anybody could be able to do a successful adaptation of the book is to do it that way. What I love about the book is it's dated, but not in a bad way. He wrote that in the mid to late 70s, and he talks about a lot of what's going on in the 70s at the time, politically specifically, because, you know, there's a political aspect to it. And The Dead Zone isn't even what I would really call a horror novel. It's more of a thriller.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And, you know, there's things that were in the book that weren't in the movie that I really kind of wanted to see. But, you know, that's just how adaptations go. And having said that, it was just absolutely fantastic. It's one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. I watch it a couple of times a year. Christopher Walken is, you know, it's Christopher Walken. The ice is gonna break.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And Martin Sheen is Greg Stilson. You couldn't have gotten a more perfect choice for Stilson, in my opinion.
I agree. Now, that's a good one. That's a good call, dude. And it's on my list. Like, it was one of the first ones I thought of, because it's a tie between that and Shawshank for my favorite King adaptations.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Good one.
Yeah, the same with Road According to Garp. It's either that or Hotel New Hampshire. Hotel New Hampshire is more my favorite book, but I think the adaptation for Garp is better. So that's why I picked that one instead.
Now I want to watch The Dead Zone again. It's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah. And they did a series, you know, with Michael C. or Anthony Hall. Michael Hall. And it was a decent series. And it ran for, you know,
a long time.
Six seasons. Yeah.
No, it was pretty good.
But the book and the movie are... Movie Files really need to watch it and read it. I love that book. Just love it.
All right. So I'm going to... I was just kidding. That Dead Zone was not going to be my last one. But
I didn't think it was. No.
So for this last one, like, people probably will guess it, but it had long been said that this was unfilmable. You know, just the scope was too big and it couldn't be done. Then when it was announced who was going to direct it, people were like, really? That dude? But I was thrilled when I had heard that it was going to be made and that principal photography was going to begin. And I can't believe it's been 25 years since principal photography started on The Lord of the Rings.
Yep, that was on my list.
Right.
The only reason I haven't mentioned it yet was I figured you would have.
Same thing with The Dead Zone. I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, The Dead Zone, Scott will probably talk about it. But yeah, The Lord of the Rings is just one of those books that for a long time was considered unfilmable because just the way it's laid out and the way Tolkien, you know, it's got all these songs in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And like all these appendices that reference locations and all this stuff, people just said it couldn't be done. And then when Peter Jackson was announced, even I myself was like, wait, the guy that did like Brain Dead and Bad Taste, like that's that Peter Jackson? Is there some other Peter Jackson that I don't know of? Then they said they were giving him like $350 million to shoot all three of them at the same time. And I'm like, Hollywood has lost its goddamn mind. But it just goes to show that only 25 years ago, movie studios were willing to take more risks than they are today.
Yeah.
You know, because let's face it, I'm a big Peter Jackson fan, but that was a risky choice.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
For such a huge movie and such a huge budget. But it seems to have turned out pretty well. with The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, another story entirely. But
yeah,
again, Lord of the Rings, it's a crowning achievement in filmmaking. There were some things that they changed where I did raise an eyebrow to say, well, that didn't really make sense. Not that I minded. Like, I realized they gave Arwen a bigger part than in the books because Liv Tyler is gorgeous and they wanted some eye candy for like the 15-year-olds that were going to go see the movie, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they give her some stuff to do that other people do. And then people are like, well, where's Bill the Pony and where's Tom Bombadil? I'm like, shut up. But to me, they are three amazing movies, you know? So yeah, I am grateful that those movies exist. Everything that happened after that with The Hobbit and with The Rings of Power. Well, we'll talk about that some other time.
Yeah, we can pretend they don't exist.
Yeah. So that's my final choice, The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I too had some eyebrow raising when they said Peter Jackson. And I remember there is a website, LOTR.net. And they started that site, and it was a fan site that they started for the movies. And it, you know, really just chronicled everything about the movie. And a lot of the extras and stuff that you see on, you know, the DVDs from the extended release came from that website. And it was just fascinating to see the process, you know, unfolding, particularly 25 years ago when the internet wasn't nearly as sophisticated as it is now.
Right.
And a lot of people were still on dial-up back then. So it just really it was amazing to see that on the website and how the movie was being filmed. But just the breadth and depth of the movie. And it won, I think, about a bazillion Oscars, all three of them combined.
Something like that. Well, The Return of the King really cleaned up, and there was speculation that they were just like the Academy was just waiting, and that it was really just rewarding the entire trilogy. When I think it won like 11 awards or 12 or something like that. It really was a sweep.
It was,
you know,
and I kind of get that. The Two Towers is probably the one I watched the least. You know, the Fellowship of the Ring, the first movie, is probably my favorite of all three. I absolutely love the world building and the introducing the characters and getting started on the quest. And I just love all of that. It just really puts you in the Shire. It really transports you. And it's one of the very few movies that I saw multiple times in a movie theater. I think I went and saw that maybe a dozen times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I absolutely, absolutely loved that movie. And I like The Two Towers, but as I said, it's the one that I watched the least. And I love Return of the King, but Jesus fucking Christ, Peter, pick an ending. You know? It's like he didn't want to stop filming, and he kept coming up with all these endings just to prolong the sorrow of no longer working on it.
See, I don't have as big a problem with that as a lot of people do. He had to tie up those threads.
No, and I understand, you know? That, and I say that with my tongue somewhat.
But you're right. I mean, you're right. I get it.
Yeah, but you know, even back then, my bladder was like, "Come on, hurry it up. Let's get this over with." You know.
I think Billy Crystal made a joke. He said, "Oh, The Return of the King won 11 Academy Awards, one for each ending."
That's fairly accurate. Yeah. But yeah, that is one of those, lightning strikes that will never probably happen again in our lifetime as far as a movie franchise going.
Agreed.
Especially with an unknown director. And I don't know what made them choose him. To this day, I still don't understand how he got that. Because the most recent movie he had made was The Frighteners. And that was only a mild success. It wasn't any kind of a runaway blockbuster. Although it's a fantastic movie.
So here, I just Googled, how did Peter Jackson get Lord of the Rings? And I'm just going to click on Variety. It says, as has been said, the reason Peter Jackson became the director associated with Lord of the Rings is that he acquired the rights from producer Saul Zantz and made a deal with Miramax. There we go. He acquired the rights.
so it was him that actually got that ball rolling.
He's okay. Like, well, look, I'm going to hire myself. That's funny.
Well, you know, if you want an adaptation, if you want to see a movie, you know, you got to make it yourself sometimes. You know,
well, that is true. But, you know, he may have acquired the rights to the adaptation or whatever, but he certainly didn't have $300 million lying around. So no. The studio still had to agree to finance the movie.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not like, otherwise it would have looked like one of his earlier movies, you know?
Yeah.
Because he would have filmed it in his backyard with a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons fans
yeah.
in costume.
Yeah, I don't think Brain Dead got him a $350 million paycheck.
No, not at all. So,
which is a shame, because it should have. I love that movie.
Agreed. All right, so before we run out of time, did you pick an adaptation that you hate?
I didn't. Go first, and I'll think of one.
So I We didn't specify, even though we usually do it. And I'm surprised that there isn't one that jumps right into your head in particular. For me, I'm going to go right back to Peter Jackson. I think the Hobbit movies were terrible. They took what's basically a children's short book novella and stretched it out over three-hour movies, and they're just terrible. And you could tell that he did not have the budget that he had for The Lord of the Rings, because a lot of the CGI is awful. I just think the adaptation of The Hobbit is awful. I like the animated version from like the 70s way better. So yeah, that's one. And there's others that I think sucked, but there's one in particular that if you don't say it, I will, because I'll be a little surprised.
The Dark Tower.
Bingo. Bingo. We have a winner. No more calls, please. We have a winner.
It, yeah. It took me a couple of moments to think of it, because we're still recording earlier than what we normally do. And I'm generally not awake when we started recording. So I'm in a little bit of a brain fog. But yes, The Dark Tower. Fucking awful movie. Fucking awful adaptation. Stephen King should sue the producers and makers of that movie for bastardizing one of the best books he ever wrote, The Dark Tower. The Dark Tower of the Gunslinger, the first book. The next six are hit or miss, in my opinion. But The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, is a classic, and they just fucked that up 12 ways to Sunday.
Yep.
And not even, you know, and I don't even care about Idris Elba as the gunslinger. You know, that.
Oh, yeah, I didn't care about that either. You know, the casting choice. I was like, okay, he's a good actor. I like him.
Well, exactly. He was a good actor. I like him. So I didn't have an issue with that. And I didn't have an issue with Matthew McConaughey as Randall Flagg, because I like Matthew McConaughey as an actor. It's just it made no sense. It makes me speechless, because I can't talk about just how shitty it is.
Agreed.
Yeah, but the good news is Mike Flanagan will be doing an adaptation of it for Amazon.
Yes, I saw that.
And if anybody can make a good Dark Tower movie, it's going to be him. And I remember for a long time it was going to be Ron Howard.
Yeah. That was bandied about for a long time.
Yeah. The idea back when he was attached to it is they were going to make a movie and then do the rest as a TV series.
Well, we shall see.
Yeah.
So that was definitely on my list of the worst. And then I said, oh, Scott's going to say The Dark Tower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know we always do our worst one with these lists, and it just completely escaped my mind yesterday.
All right. Normally I will mention some honorable mentions, but I'm not gonna, because I think we can do a part two of this.
Oh, absolutely.
Someday. So
yes,
I will keep those in my back pocket.
Yes, so, I will too.
All right. We all got right. Working.
All right. So I think I mentioned on the last show, or maybe it was the show that hasn't aired yet, I was having difficulty formatting the Word document with Amazon and Draft Digital to publish it. And I was going to have somebody do the formatting for me. Well, you know, thank God for YouTube, because I watched a couple of videos on YouTube and it fixed the issues that I was having for the most part. Nice. There's a couple of things that I still need to kind of fix again. But it's still going to come out on April 22nd. It's not going to be April 1st anymore. As I said the last time I mentioned it, it'll be April 22nd, which I think is kind of fitting somehow, because that would have been my mother's 83rd birthday.
Mm.
So, but that will be coming out. And the ideas for Spectre Street are coming in fast and furious, and so I'm writing down how that's going to go. And it's going to be really interesting because it's, and I don't know that I mentioned this, but it's going to have a straight female protagonist.
Oh, wow.
Which is very different. Yeah. Now, there's still going to be a gay character in it. Just because I can't not write a gay character in my stuff. But he's going to have more of a supporting role. But it's going to be this character's, story to tell. And I'm excited about that. I'm a little nervous because, I don't write female characters. And if I do, they're very, very minor, like a brothel owner, like what's in the Tree of Everlasting Sorrow. But I want to expand and build and broaden my horizons with characters, and this is a good way to do it. So I'm excited about this.
Cool.
And of course, you can get my books at Amazon, and you can get the ebooks wherever ebooks are sold, and you can get the audiobooks at audible.com. All right. And so, what have you got going on?
All right. Well, the submissions are still open for Grindhouse Nights Film Festival. So, you find us on Film Freeway. Look up just Grindhouse Nights Film Festival. The submissions are coming in. We do have some time, but you know what? It's already the end of March. How is that even possible?
I don't know. I was just thinking that. Yeah, right? It's going to be April already. Jesus. Right?
So get your submissions in. I've been watching some of the films that so far. There's some pretty cool stuff. There always is. And your man of the hour, Scott Colbert, is also a judge again this year. So we're happy to have him. And the weekend of, let me get the dates right, the weekend of April 19th, 20th, and 21st, I will be at New Jersey HorrorCon at the New Jersey Expo Center in Edison, New Jersey, doing press like I usually do and helping out. Theater of Terror and Tom Ryan will also have a filmmaker table at New Jersey HorrorCon. And I want to make sure I get this right, because we just announced, give me a second, I'm sorry. I should have had this handy. We have a special screening of Return to the Theater of Terror on Friday, April the 19th at 7:30 p.m. at New Jersey HorrorCon. So,
ooh, awesome.
If you're at the convention, or even if you're not at the convention and you want to come by and check out the screening, that will be Friday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m., New Jersey HorrorCon at the New Jersey Expo Center in Edison, New Jersey.
Awesome. And until next time, may all of your journeys be filled with pure imagination.